Since September 2nd, the U.S. military, on orders of President Trump, has targeted at least four boats suspected of carrying drugs in the Caribbean Sea, reportedly killing 21 people to date. 1 month into these events, what do we actually know about the people killed and the vessels targeted? What legal justifications is the administration putting forward, and are they viable? Is there anything to stop the president from making further terrorist designations of citizens or non-citizens and ordering the military to use lethal force against those he designates? And what checks exist in Congress, in the courts, or within the executive branch itself on the president's claimed authority to order killings in these circumstances? This is the Just Security Podcast. I'm your host, Tess Bridgman, co-editor-in-chief of Just Security and senior fellow and visiting scholar at NYU Law School's Reese Center on Law and Security. I'm joined today by co-host Rachel Goldbrenner, who's executive director of the Reese Center. And joining us to break down the facts, the law, and the implications of these killings at sea are Rebecca Ingber and Brian Finucane. Rebecca is a professor at Cardozo Law School and has served several rounds in government, including most recently as the former counselor on international law at the U.S. State Department. She's written extensively on matters of presidential powers, international law, and national security. And Brian Finucane, who's a former State Department attorney, now senior advisor at International Crisis Group, also with deep expertise in war powers, the use of force, and the intersection of domestic and international law. Beck, Brian, and I are all senior fellows at the Reese Center on Law and Security, and I'll turn it over now to my co-host, Rachel Goldbrenner.
Thanks very much, Tess. I thought that we would just start with establishing where we are and what is the lay of the land. So this group last convened on this podcast about a month ago, in the wake of the Trump administration's first announced lethal strike in the Caribbean Sea that killed 11 people. So what have been the major developments since then? We'll come back to many of them to discuss in more detail later in this conversation. But just to lay the facts out up front, Brian, maybe I'll turn to you to just walk us through what we know, what we don't know about the strikes today.
Okay, so there have been now four strikes, at least four strikes in the Caribbean, lethal strikes. The administration has made various assertions about who might have been aboard the vessels and how they might have been affiliated. It has not substantiated them, but even those assertions that are fairly high level of generality. So appeared to have been all four vessels were reportedly outside the territorial waters of any state. The administration has spoken generically of the people aboard them being, quote, narco-terrorists or in some way affiliated with designated terrorist organizations. But beyond that, it's not specified who those people were or the exact identity of the groups to whom they belonged. President Trump referred to Trendaragua with respect to the first strike that killed 11 people, but the administration didn't actually repeat that claim in its formal legal notifications. The administration has moreover not described or identified what the cargoes were aboard these vessels. It has spoken about narcotics or drugs being smuggled, but it hasn't gone into detail. It is likely, based on the geography and what is coming out of northern South America, that if there were drugs aboard, it was not fentanyl, but instead cocaine. And so the most recent strike occurred on Friday, October 3rd. And that brings us up to 21 people killed, based on the U.S. government's own math. There have been a few interviews, both by local press and with the New York Times, with family members of those killed or allegedly killed aboard these vessels. In one of the New York Times accounts, the wife of a man who was allegedly killed aboard one of these vessels says that he was a fisherman. Now, we've got at least two legal communications from the administration to Congress with respect to these actions. The first is dated the 4th of September, and this is a notification under the War Powers Resolution with respect to the first strike. And it includes the assertion that the president was acting under Article 2 of the Constitution, pursuant to his authority as commander-in-chief and chief executive to order the strike without congressional authorization. And then more recently, last week, there was revealed to be a non-public submission to Congress, though unclassified, under 50 U.S.C. 1543A. This is an additional reporting requirement that provides additional legal arguments that we can get into about the strikes in the Caribbean.
Great, thanks. And just to understand, is the way that this information is being released and disclosed sort of normal course? Is this how we would see it in the past? Or is this a divergence in some way? You mentioned that the facts are at a high level of generality. Is that typical?
So there's a lot that's unusual about this. These reports that I just mentioned, both were transmitted to Congress, but they were not posted on the White House website, which is the more normal order of events. I and others have gotten these from various sources on Capitol Hill, even though the documents are not classified. And then the information contained within them, again, is very nonspecific. And there are repeated references to designated terrorist organizations, but doesn't actually tell us which ones, which is unusual with respect to these sorts of reports when the U.S. is engaged in military action against, you know, a group overseas.
And let's stay with you for one more question, Brian, because you mentioned that the initial War Powers Report and the second notification mention Article 2 of the Constitution as the supposed domestic legal authority for the president to be undertaking these strikes. So let's just break that down first, the domestic law question. Does the president have the authority under Article 2 of the Constitution or otherwise to order these killings?
Short answer is no. And this is a complicated situation in some respects, but it's also very simple in others. What we have going on here are premeditated killings outside of armed conflict and outside of any, you know, plausible claim of self-defense. There is a term of premeditated killing, and that term is murder. Okay, so that's really what's at stake here. Now, in terms of the Article 2 justifications here, it is true that the executive branch has very permissive doctrine on when the president may use military force without prior congressional authorization, but it runs into some real challenges in this context here. Okay, you know, there's no plausible claim that there was an effort to repel a sort of sudden attack on the United States, which is the, you know, we look at this as the sort of originalist touchstone for unilateral executive power to use force. But also, and I think really significantly here, we have some criminal statutes in play. Okay. And we can get into in a moment whether or not there's an armed conflict and that might law of armed conflict might provide an escape hatch or otherwise permit these actions. But in the case where you have, you know, criminal statutes in play, not only is it, you know, the specter of criminal liability for U.S. personnel real, but the president himself has constitutional obligations under the Take Care Clause to take care of the laws be faithfully executed. And those include criminal statutes enacted by Congress, okay? So Article 2 is not just a source of authority for the president, but also binding constitutional obligations. And I think if you also look at this through the lens of Youngstown, we're in a sort of a lowest ebb scenario here where, you know, it's not just that Congress has not acted to authorize these actions, but to the contrary, Congress has acted to prohibit these actions by enacting criminal statutes here. And so the claim of authority here is that the president acting under Article 2 is acting in the face of express congressional prohibitions under Title 18, where there's criminal prohibitions on murder on the high seas, as well as conspiracy to commit murder outside the United States, as well as Article 118 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which also criminalizes murder.
And those of us who have been following executive branch claims for when the president can unilaterally use force abroad, I think would also note, in addition to that helpful overview, Brian, that there's been no claim like this ever in the history of presidential reliance on Article 2 to use force that we're aware of, that he's simply outside of armed conflict, outside of any claimed threat to the United States, orders the military to engage in killings on purported Article 2 authority alone. I think the novelty of that and the breadth of that is something that we should also all be keeping in mind. And then, as Brian, you know, not only that, but in the face of congressionally enacted statutes that prohibit exactly that conduct, otherwise known as the prohibitions on murder found in our criminal law. And turning to you now back on some of the claims that the administration is making under international law, or kind of more to the point, the claim that surfaced just last week that the United States is in an armed conflict, what the president termed a non-international armed conflict in his notice to Congress, with, quote, organized armed groups, which are in theory the drug cartels, although he didn't specify which ones, and that the United States had faced a supposed armed attack from those groups. So all of these are terms of art in international law, right? Armed attack, organized armed group, non-international armed conflict. And these are terms that, in my view, of course, don't apply here at all, but I'm hoping you can talk us through what do these terms mean? Why is the administration using them, and kind of what's their import in this context?
Yeah, thanks, Tess. So the administration has been trying to use this wartime framework to explain and justify these attacks. And there are reasons for doing so. There are political reasons, there are legal reasons that we can get to, some of which you guys have hinted to already. But Tess, as you note, in this latest memorandum to Congress, President used a number of legal terms of art: self-defense against an armed attack, non-international armed conflict, all of which come from international law and that have real legal meaning. And so it's worth parsing through what they all mean. And in order to do that, we have to talk about all of these different legal terms, and it might seem complicated, or at least that risks making it look complicated. And so I just want to say up front that this situation is not complicated at all. This is murder, pure and simple, just as Brian said. But because the state does have authority to kill in exceptional circumstances, and specifically in war, as long as it follows certain rules, we have to parse through why this is not that. Why those rules are not the right legal framework here, and why in this case, even if they were the right legal framework, these murders would not actually satisfy those rules. So the administration is claiming a few things here. They're claiming self-defense to an armed attack, and they're claiming that we're in a non-international armed conflict, a NIAC, with some amorphous group of drug cartels. So let's just take these one at a time. Start with self-defense. At the most basic level, taking out suspected criminals whom the government itself says it could have interdicted is not self-defense. It's not self-defense at an individual level, and it's not self-defense at the state level. It's just murder, as we've said. But the framework they're trying to invoke is one that governs how states may respond to an actual or imminent armed attack. And under international law, states cannot use force against other states unless they're responding in self-defense to an armed attack. So after 9/11, the United States considered those attacks to rise to the level of an armed attack, even though they were committed by non-state actors, in that case, Al-Qaeda. But we were talking about events that killed 3,000 people, attacks on the World Trade Center and on the Pentagon, in addition to a third attack, and attacks that were the most significant attacks on this country since Pearl Harbor. So in the case at hand, the administration has pointed to no armed attack on the United States. They have not actually even pointed to a single use of force against the United States. So they haven't made out a bare minimum claim to be acting in self-defense to an armed attack. And so then what is this claim that we're in an armed conflict, specifically a NIAC or a non-international armed conflict with these amorphously defined drug cartels? Does that add anything to this claim? So it is really important to note up front that the determination of an armed conflict is not itself a grounds to use force. The grounds to use force would be the self-defense against an armed attack, which we don't have. If we don't have that, which we don't here, if we're not responding to an actual or imminent armed attack that requires the use of self-defense in order to repel it, then we can't use force. So why then is armed conflict important? Well, it works like a choice of law predicate. An armed conflict triggers the application of the international law of armed conflict. When states are in an armed conflict, they have to follow this body of law. It works as a set of constraints that the state has to follow when it's engaging in armed conflict. So, for example, when we talk about war crimes, like the intentional targeting of civilians, we're talking about this body of law. Now, is the president claiming that we're in an armed conflict because he wants to trigger the Geneva Conventions or the War Crimes Act? He is not, obviously. He's claiming it because prior presidents have claimed an exception to the normal operation of domestic laws, like the murder statute that Brian mentioned, for lawful killing in an armed conflict. So in order to do so, he'd need to argue successfully that this is an armed conflict. And if it is an armed conflict, this is a lawful killing within that. And if it's an armed conflict, but an unlawful killing, like the targeted killings of civilians, that would be a war crime. Okay.
So to try to distill that first, the part where you said that it's like a choice of law question for those non-lawyers who might be listening. Can we think of this as sort of an on-off switch? If we are at war, right, if there is an armed conflict, it is lawful to kill combatants, still not lawful to kill civilians, but it's lawful to kill combatants so long as they're not sick, injured, et cetera, right? But there's an off switch. If we're not in armed conflict, it is not lawful to kill based on the status of an individual, right? You have to be acting in self-defense if there's an imminent risk, right, to your life or serious bodily injury. Can we think of it as sort of an on-off switch if we're in armed conflict or not in terms of when status-based killing is lawful?
Yes, and this is important for both domestic and international law, and these are factual determinations. So to have an armed conflict, well, to have an armed conflict between two states, we have a very high bar. Generally, acts between states that involve the use of force between militaries would trigger an armed conflict. And we do that, we have that low bar for conflict between states because we want to impose this set of constraints on states that they not kill one another outside of the laws of armed conflict, that if they're detaining the military, if they're detaining a soldier from another state, that they do so only according to the laws of armed conflict, they give them prisoner of war status, et cetera. For a conflict with a non-state actor, it's a little more complicated because we don't have obvious state militaries. And so we can't just have the same kind of obvious trigger. And so the way that international tribunals, but also states have accepted the definition for or the test for when you can have an armed conflict between a state and a non-state actor has two prongs, and they both have to be met. We have to be dealing with an organized armed group, and that's a legal term of art. It has to have a command structure. It has to have military capability. It has to have organization that suggests it's capable of acting similar to a state military. So basically, does it look like a state military? And is it engaged in protracted armed violence with the state? So law provides the legal framework for ascertaining when these are met, but they boil down to pretty simple concepts that I think we can all understand. Does the group have the structure and capability of a state military? And is there military violence happening between the two entities? So just think Al-Qaeda in its decades-long conflict with the United States, or a true ongoing civil war.
And to be clear, the administration is claiming that instead of military violence, supplying drugs, which can then end up killing people, is sufficient. That's what the claim boils down to, if I have that right, based on their notice to Congress.
That's my understanding. I mean, they weren't particularly clear. They haven't actually suggested any clear use of force, any clear hostilities. What we're dealing with is simply a criminal organization. Lots of criminals do terrible things, including sell drugs, including engage in acts of violence, right? But that does not amount to the kinds of prolonged hostilities against the state that we're talking about when we talk about armed conflict. It doesn't mean we're in an armed conflict with those groups.
I think that some of the language from that last notice is these groups illegally and directly caused the deaths of tens of thousands of American citizens each year. And then later, this says these groups are now transnational and conduct ongoing attacks throughout the Western Hemisphere as organized cartels, which presumably refers to the deaths that were referred to above.
Yeah, the only we haven't seen anything that would actually amount to kinetic operations that would actually be attacks under the laws of armed conflict, the laws of war, jus ad bellum. So what we're seeing is a conflation of criminal activity with attacks that have legal legal content under international law.
On the language of the latest report, I think it's worth noting that I think there's a actual acknowledgement by whoever prepared this, presumably career lawyers at the DOD and perhaps the State Department, that they couldn't actually make out the case that they would need to, as Rebecca has just described, for the U.S. having suffered an armed attack or the U.S. being engaged in a non-international armed conflict, because they evoke this shortcut, which is that the president has determined that the United States has suffered an armed attack, or the president has determined the United States is in a non-international armed conflict. And so what, in essence, is the administration is simply asserting by fiat, in the absence of facts that would actually support these conclusions, asserting by fiat that it's reached this conclusion.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And it also is very clearly not suggesting that Congress has made this determination, right? There's no authorization to use military force here from Congress, although that is another question that we could discuss.
And on that point, Brian, just to follow up, the designation of these groups, or some amount of groups, presumably, which are these, as foreign terrorist organizations, can you explain how that comes into play here, whether it does, what the administration might claim?
So as a strict legal matter, it offers nothing in terms of providing any legal authority to use military force or magically transforming the designated entity or individuals into lawful targets. Beginning in February, the administration designated for the very first time in an unprecedented fashion, designated various Latin American criminal groups as foreign terrorist organizations. And that what that means in legal terms is that there are both visa and financial sanctions imposed on those groups and their members. And it also makes material support to those entities a crime. Okay. But again, it doesn't offer any authority to use force. Nonetheless, it was quite clear that politically and bureaucratically, that was a step towards paving the way towards military action based on statements made publicly by members of the administration, but also based on my own conversations with people inside the government. There was a widespread misunderstanding that, okay, well, you've designated these groups as FTOs, that means we can start doing drone strikes, okay? And so that was an ominous step, and unfortunately pretty clear to me where this was headed back in February. And again, this is a unilateral action by the executive branch, and it was unprecedented to apply these designations to what are criminal groups, but not terrorist organizations in the sense that we typically think of terrorist organizations.
Because they're not engaged in political violence, right? And they don't have the kinds of goals terrorists tend to have normally defined, and because they have a profit motive, right? These are, at the end of the day, people selling a product. It's a unlawful activity to engage in, and it results in enormous amounts of harm to millions of people. But at the end of the day, their motive is a business motive, not a political motive. And the kinds of violence they engage in are not the kinds of, as certainly within the United States anyway, it's not the kind of violence that you see terrorist groups engaging in. One of the things that after Beck laid out, you know, why the administration is claiming the use of these so-called armed conflict authorities to kind of get around the domestic murder statute, right? It's the only escape hatch, as you put it, Brian. I'm wondering sort of two things. One, let's talk a little bit more about the implications of kind of using that framework and how it applies here. But before maybe I turn to you for that, Beck, Brian, can I just stay with you for 1 minute on another domestic framework statute that is at play here that we've referenced a couple times in this conversation already, which is the War Powers Resolution. And as we've noted, the administration sent a notice to Congress within 2 days of the first strike, which is required under the War Powers Resolution, saying just a few basic things about the strike that are required in that statute, right? Including the purpose, the likely duration, et cetera. And the administration in that notice said that more of these kinds of strikes are likely to come, basically, which is what they were saying from the podium as well. And under the War Powers Resolution, when U.S. forces are introduced into hostilities, which is what this would be under the War Powers Resolution, if not authorized by Congress, those forces have to be removed within 60 days of that notice. So this is known as the 60-day clock or the 60-day termination clock that basically provides an automatic off switch for the use of U.S. armed forces in hostilities, if not authorized by Congress. By my calculations, if that first report was September 4th, we're looking at around November 4th as that automatic off switch, the end of the termination clock period. But of course, then we get into a really difficult situation with respect to how that gets enforced. So Brian, I'm hoping you can just talk us through, do you see the 60-day clock as implicated here? Is that your analysis that we're looking at around November 4th as the potential 60-day clock deadline? And then what can Congress or other actors do about it if this goes on after the 60-day mark?
Thanks, Tess. There's a few key points here I want to emphasize. One, even though the War Powers Resolution doesn't define the term hostilities or what it means for U.S. armed forces to be introduced into hostilities, there is longstanding executive branch practice to treat U.S. airstrikes, even when there's no returning fire, to treat U.S. airstrikes as constituting an introduction of U.S. armed forces in hostilities, and to report them under the relevant reporting provision of the War Powers Resolution. Okay. You and I are both familiar with that practice, have engaged in our prepare such reports ourselves when we were in government. And so the communication on dated the 4th of September in connection with the first strike, I read to be a tacit acknowledgement that that strike, for the purposes of the War Powers Resolution, constituted the introduction of U.S. armed forces into hostilities. And I want to emphasize that is quite distinct from the question of whether or not there's an armed conflict for international law purposes. As we've discussed, there is not. Okay. But nonetheless, for the purpose of the War Powers Resolution, that strike could still constitute hostilities, still trigger the 60-day clock. Okay. That clock, in my view, is running. But it also means that Congress has additional tools available to it. Once U.S. armed forces are engaged in hostilities, there are expedited procedures in both the House and the Senate to bring legislation forward to require the removal of U.S. armed forces from those hostilities. And we have such measures introduced into both houses of Congress. We have a joint resolution from Senators Schiff and Kaine in the Senate. We have a joint resolution from Congressman Crow, as well as a concurrent resolution from Congressman Omar in the House. Okay, so that's, I think, probably the best available tool to Congress at this moment to force the removal of U.S. armed forces. In addition, the clock is ticking, and even if these legislative measures fail, under my view of the law, that the administration would be required to remove U.S. armed forces from this situation unless Congress votes to authorize it. Now, I think you mentioned that the question of, you know, recourse to courts, that's challenging. The track record of members of Congress seeking to enforce the War Powers Resolution via the courts is not particularly encouraging. For a variety of reasons, including relating to congressional standing. But I just want to, you know, emphasize that the clock is ticking. My view runs out in early November. And before then, Congress has an opportunity to vote to require the removal of these forces. And even if those votes fail, they could nonetheless send an important political signal to the White House about congressional opposition to this ongoing action.
So with these votes, Congress can essentially be saying, look, this is murder. These are pre-planned killings that are not excused in the law for any reason. This is not an armed conflict. There's no self-defense justification. Nevertheless, you are using the armed forces in these hostile actions and have reported them under the War Powers Resolution, which starts the 60-day clock. We can use the mechanisms under the War Powers Resolution to try to terminate this activity as soon as we can take a vote. But assuming those votes fail, that's not the end of the story. The 60-day clock is ticking anyway. And by operation of law, at the end of those 60 days, the president needs to remove those armed forces. The question is going to be what happens if push comes to shove and he doesn't. Important to keep in mind that, again, by operation of law, that termination is required no matter what happens with the votes that precede it. Maybe I'll turn back over to you, Rachel, to tease out some of the implications with Beck.
Yeah, great. So we've been talking a lot about legal theories and their expansion in this context and unprecedented usage. So we can see sort of in the immediate term what these theories are being applied to and why. But can you tell us a little bit about what this might be laying the groundwork for in the future, either deliberately or just setting a precedent that could be picked up in the future, either by this administration or another? You know, in what are the kinds of contexts that we could see these new expansive theories applied in the future?
Wow, that's a great question and a frightening one. I mean, when we think about, you know, if you go back in time to the 2001 AUMF in the aftermath of Al-Qaeda, Congress at the time rejected a request by the White House to give the president sort of unlimited power to fight terrorism. And very clearly linked the authorization to use military force to the specific attacks of 9/11. But I think we saw in the last 25 years that even with I would say in most cases, the best of intentions. In many administrations have used force against groups and people that have become sort of further and further attenuated from those from that initial sort of requisite grounding for that statute. But nevertheless, always sought legal legal justifications that tied it to those acts. In this case, there does not seem to be any limiting principle to what the president is asserting. And there's not a geographic limiting principle. There's not really a limiting principle in terms of the actors against whom he's asserting the authority to use force. And, you know, sort of at the highest level, the president has pretty extraordinary powers in wartime. As relevant here, he can kill people in many circumstances without any process whatsoever. So if he can declare sort of anything to be war, that makes that power virtually limitless. If he could do this on the high seas by simply calling these people terrorists, he could do it anywhere, including inside the United States. And just think about who members of this administration have called terrorists just this week. Stephen Miller recently referred to, I believe, attorneys general of states and judges as part of a terrorist network. So there are implications that are sort of perhaps beyond our wildest imagination right now, but these strikes would have been beyond my wildest imaginations just a year ago. And they're not the only area where the president's seeking to use a wartime lens in the idea that it's going to give him some greater authority, where he doesn't want to be constrained by the normal operation of law. So he's been claiming the authority to arrest and remove people and has been rounding up people with virtually no process under the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, under a theory that the immigration of people he claims are connected to particular drug cartels actually is an invasion of the United States. And many judges, including most recently the Fifth Circuit, have pushed back on that. But we don't know where that's going to go ultimately. And whether or not this is like sort of a tail wagging the dog situation, right? I don't know that he's necessarily trying to create an armed conflict in order to win those cases, but it's pretty clear that he is seeking to use and has already used wartime authorities, both domestically and internationally, in the context of both criminal law enforcement and immigration. And so I think there's real risk for where that could go forward domestically. And of course, there's a real risk of global escalation as well.
And Brian, I know that you've done some thinking about this in the context of your day job at International Crisis Group. So if there's anything that you'd want to add.
No, I just to further emphasize what Rebecca just said, you know, this administration has framed not just Latin American narcos as terrorists, but also domestic political opponents and immigrants more generally. And so given the absence of any limiting principle, and this is sort of prerogative to, you know, kill outside the law, it's extremely concerning of how this might be wielded elsewhere.
Okay, so maybe that brings us to discuss what are the limitations. There's no limiting principles in the theories, as you've said, but what are the checks on the exercise of this power or the advancement of these theories? What you know, who decides the answers to these questions that we've raised in this conversation that many others have raised? You know, what might we expect to see as a check against the executive branch from other branches of government or elsewhere? Brian, maybe you can follow up on that first.
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, I think that, you know, efforts in Congress are going to be the most consequential here to push back against what is the executive's usurpation of Congress's powers over the military and apparent violations of criminal laws here. And I think it's, you know, not terribly realistic to hope for judicial intervention, at least at this point. Maybe if there are detainees taken, you could see habeas action. And to follow up from our conversation a few weeks ago, you know, I don't think it's realistic to place your hopes on actors within the U.S. military to push back against the commander in chief. I think it's unrealistic and probably unfair to hope that U.S. service members are going to push back here. So it's really Congress's job. They're the institutional actor that has responsibility here to push back.
Go ahead, Beck, if there's anything you want to add on that.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I think that one of the things that we can see so starkly in this case is just how important the guardrails inside the executive branch have been. And I think that the courts and Congress and the public have all come to rely upon those guardrails so heavily that they have lost the muscle memory for how to react when those guardrails are absent. And so they're slow to react. Under any responsible administration that any of us have served in, this idea would never have made it anywhere. It wouldn't have made it outside of a low-level room of a conversation. And the other branches and the courts and Congress and maybe the public tend to put a lot of faith in that. And we've seen sort of this presumption that the courts continue to operate under, especially the Supreme Court. They so firmly want to believe that things are still operating as sort of normal and that there's still these internal checks. And they are very slow to recognize what's becoming blatantly obvious to many of us, that many of those guardrails are gone. And it's really time for everyone else to step up. It's time for Congress. It's time for members of the judiciary. And I think the public, we all have to realize that it's time for us to stand up for the rule of law. I've heard so many people say, okay, but the law, like, let's not focus on the law, because what people really want to know about is, why does this matter in terms of policy? But then what people are concerned about is, well, can the president do this anywhere? Is there, if the president could do it here, can he do it on the streets? The reason that what he's claiming has no limiting principle is because of law. And what we actually want is a president constrained by law, not just his say-so. And so we have to continue to care about and believe in public law in order for public law to continue to constrain the president.
And this is something that we also wanted to touch on, all of us being lawyers here in this discussion. What is the role of lawyers in that process, Beck? And I just want to start with saying, I think something that you and Brian have both echoed, which is that we have put service members in an incredibly difficult position here. After Trump v. United States, right? Trump himself has immunity, likely, in terms of any criminal consequences for these killings he's ordering, whereas those below him in the chain of command likely do not, at least they don't yet under current Supreme Court precedent. I think we have seen, though, former uniformed attorneys, former JAGs, speaking out already about the position that the military has been put in, that those in uniform have been put in with these operations. Some of the guidance that's been offered to date: identify and document unlawful orders, speak up, put your concerns in writing, and be willing to resign if you need to. This is a lot to ask, right, of anyone serving. They face the prospects of getting court-martialed themselves, right? They lose their rank, their career. The circumstances that those who are serving have been put under here, it can't be overemphasized, are really awful for them as individuals. But the consequences for us as a nation, if the military is reduced to an organization that unquestioningly follows unlawful orders, is also unthinkable. So we're really in a dire situation here in terms of the rock and a hard place there. But just thinking more broadly, kind of about the role of lawyers and the role of the bureaucracy, we don't know exactly who signed off on these killings before they started. We don't know if AG Bondi signed off. We don't know if OLC was consulted for an opinion. It does appear that the DOD Office of General Counsel signed off, at least at the leadership level, based on some closed briefings to Congress that apparently did not go very well in terms of offering a legal rationale. And we don't know as well at what point the decision that this is a so-called NIAC motivated any of the actions taken, right? Because that notice to Congress didn't come until well after the first few strikes. So we don't know if the administration simply thinks the terrorist label is sufficient, whether you're in an armed conflict or not, or whether the NIAC theory preceded, right, this kind of tempo of killings. But what we do know is that there is a lot going on within the bureaucracy that's not just the president orders, and then the person with their finger on the trigger pulls the trigger. There's a lot that goes on kind of throughout the bureaucracy, if you will, for an order to be translated into action like that. So Beck, I'm just wondering, you know, given your writings in the past on this, what do you make of kind of where we are and what, if anything, could be done at this point from inside the bureaucracy going forward?
Well, I'll start with something that's not particularly heartening, which is that, I've written about this before, the bureaucracy is not going to save us from a president who is determined to be a tyrant or determined to act unlawfully. That's especially true today when the president has shown very little, this administration has shown very little interest in trying to stay within the bounds of both norms and law with respect to whom they can fire, organizational, they have raised entire agencies to the ground and departments inside those agencies, offices inside those agencies. And Congress has more or less hung these people out to dry. Congress, who created and protected through legislation the career bureaucracy, has left them, right? The courts have largely left them. And so the bureaucracy alone, there's a lot of talk about the idea of a deep state, right? But the bureaucracy alone is not steering the ship. It never has, it never will. And the only power that the bureaucracy has derives from politically accountable actors. It derives from the president being willing to accept that the that engaging with the bureaucracy legitimizes his actions, and through the protections that the courts and Congress can give it. When all of that is gone, the bureaucracy is effectively neutered in terms of any constraint on presidential power.
Well, thank you, Beck, for this. Difficult thoughts, but very incisive. Perhaps it would be the right time to ask. I mean, I think that this is a conversation that will unfortunately undoubtedly be ongoing, and we don't know exactly what lies ahead. You know, we asked the question of what are the implications? What could these theories be applied to in the future? But I think we will see what happens. We'll see what happens on the Hill within the executive branch. Perhaps we'll have answers to some of the questions that we raised today. But for now, for today, where we are a month from when we started, I just wondered if any of you wanted to share parting thoughts, including you, Tess, on what to be thinking about, looking out for as we move ahead.
Yeah, I can start, Rachel, by saying I think the framing that both Brian and Beck raised at the top is exactly right, which is, you know, the administration is trying to invoke the war powers. It's trying to use words like terrorist and armed conflict and combatant to fuzz up the picture, to make it seem like it's about bad guys somewhere else, you know, abroad. And it's, you know, similar to what the United States has done for years in terms of targeting those who are a threat to the United States. All of that is a distraction, both because none of it is actually true in terms of applying the facts here to the law, but also because what's actually happened here is so clear cut. The administration has decided that the president is going to designate those people that he does not like for one reason or another. In this case, it is because they're suspected drug traffickers as terrorists, and order the military to then kill them on site without due process, without any of the legal guardrails that apply under U.S. domestic law, under international human rights law that binds the United States or otherwise. That should be chilling to all of us, and we need to recognize it for what it is. As Beck said, if he can do it in the high seas, he can do it anywhere. If he can do it to suspected drug traffickers, he can do it in the United States. No limiting principle has been articulated. Who gets labeled a terrorist seems to just be whatever the president says. Who gets called an unlawful combatant seems to just be whatever the president says, or at least if there's any more to it that hasn't been shared with Congress or the American people yet. So Congress and the American people need to keep asking these questions. We need to get to the bottom of what they think they're doing and on what basis, who's signed off on it, if there are any limiting principles being invoked. But let's just be clear about what's actually going on here. And let's be clear about the potential consequences, because otherwise we risk normalizing a situation where the president can order anyone he doesn't like to be deemed a terrorist and killed without due process. And that's something that we need to stay really clear-eyed about.
Others? Beck or Brian?
I would concur with that 100%. And I would also urge people not to give in to legal or constitutional defeatism here. There should be an expectation that the U.S. Congress will fulfill its constitutional responsibilities.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that entirely, both of you. And I like the word expectation. I think that to the extent people lose any faith or expectation that the president will abide by law, this argument that we hear a lot, well, what did you expect? Obviously, these guys aren't going to, obviously, they don't care about law. So why do you keep talking about it? The idea that we don't expect Congress to push back on the president, that is a sort of nihilistic attitude that's going to be self-fulfilling. So we have to think about what kind of government do we want to live under? Do we want rule by law, laws that that are based on neutral principles that we understand, or do we want something arbitrary where at any moment the president can take someone out? Which, again, it seems fanciful, and yet that's exactly what's going on. And I keep hearing, well, these are bad guys, so how much do people really care about it? And I'd like to know, first of all, we don't have the death penalty as a country for drug smuggling. So this isn't something we have decided is the way we actually handle this kind of activity, even if they did receive due process. Second of all, I haven't seen any hard evidence of who was involved in these strikes. We don't know who they are. We don't know if they were mere fishermen. We know that the president is threatening fishermen generally in the entire area to steer clear. Why would he be doing so if he was so confident in his intelligence? We keep talking about a limiting principle, but I'm thinking about those raids in Chicago and imagining those kids in zip ties, and imagine the federal government decided instead of going through all that trouble, they were just going to drop a bomb on the building because there's a suspected narco-terrorist living in there and everyone else is collateral damage. So too, the playground your kids play at next door. So that's the kind of scenario we're talking about when we talk about no limiting principle. And I think it should be terrifying to everyone.
With that sobering thought, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. As you all know, this is the Just Security Podcast. It was co-hosted by me, Tess Bridgman, with Rachel Goldbrenner. It was produced by Maya Neer and Isaac Rubenstein. Special thanks to both of our guests, Rebecca Ingber and Brian Finucane. You can read all of Just Security's coverage of the vessel strikes in the Caribbean on our website. And for a comprehensive, open source, and living resource on war powers, please check out the show notes for a link to the War Powers Resolution Reporting Project at NYU Law's Reese Center on Law and Security. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.